Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we've been talking salary cap implications and projections. But of course, game two of the Stanley Cup final goes tonight in Florida. The Oilers down a game in the series, looking to even things up. And we will check in on the Stanley Cup final now. He works for Oilers Nation, covering the Edmonton Oilers. He is Zach Lang. Zach, thank you for doing this. How are you today?
Hey, guys. I'm doing good, thanks. I'm doing good, getting excited and geared up for what should be a really big game tonight.
Yeah, I mean, it was 3-0, all obviously final result with the late empty net goal, but I really enjoyed game one. I'm excited for game two. For you, looking at the game one loss from Edmonton's perspective, is it as simple as, hey, we got goalied, Bobrovsky was incredible, we generated a ton, just keep doing that and we'll be all right? Or do you see a little bit more cause for concern in it than that?
Yeah, I think that kind of summarizes it pretty good. I mean, the Oilers really got goalied by Bobrovsky in that game. He stood on his head and made stop after stop. You know, even in the first period, the Oilers had two or three breakaway chances and they couldn't capitalize. And, you know, for the Oilers, I think one of the big keys to this game here tonight is going to be elevating the puck. The overwhelming majority of their shots came down low against Bobrovsky, hitting him off the pads. And so I think for the Oilers, you know, they got to kind of adjust a little bit. And they tried to win game last in game one, but, you know, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Zach Hyman, they had a couple of good opportunities that they put over top of the net. So they just got to bear down on these chances a little bit. And then I think defensively too, you know, they got to clean up those kind of big mistakes. You saw the two goals against, and both of them kind of came off of rush opportunities by the Canucks. And, you know, Cody Ceci.
Canucks.
Oh, yeah, sorry, the Panthers, sorry.
That's all right.
And, yeah, I was just – no, that's okay. I just had a call coming in on the other line, so I got distracted for a second there. But you look at those two goals against, and they were both goals that were scored off the rush. So Cody Ceci is going to sit tonight for game two. This is the first time this has happened since the Oilers signed him a number of years ago. So it's going to be interesting to see the way the defense works tonight.
Yeah, obviously, as you mentioned, the news going into tonight from a lineup perspective, Cody Ceci is going to be a healthy scratch. And, of course, the Ceci-Nurse pairing has been under so much scrutiny all postseason long for the Oilers. One of the interesting things from game one is Philip Broberg, who hasn't been a regular in the playoffs, ended up playing, I think, the second most 5-on-5 minutes on the blue line for the Oilers, behind only Evan Bouchard. So with Ceci out, perhaps an increased role for Philip Broberg, what's the kind of best configuration in your view for the Oilers blue line in this series?
I like the way that it's shaping up right now, quite honestly. If Cody Ceci was in the lineup, I think Darnay staying out would be okay. You know, we saw Broberg and Ceci look good against Dallas in those last couple of games there. And Philip Broberg has taken some significant steps forward in his career. You know, it's been a much maligned pick in the Ken Holland era, you know, taking Broberg eighth overall when guys like Cole Caulfield and Matthew Boldy were still on the board. But Broberg is starting to kind of come into his own. And here in Edmonton, he's been reminding me of Oscar Klefbom from a number of years ago, a guy who I think can be a very, very solid two-way defenseman. He moves the puck tremendously well. He skates well. He's got a great pass, a great first pass. And for him, you know, it was a tough start to the season. You know, he was a healthy scratch in the majority of the games early on in the season. And then there was a trade request in December that kind of came public because Broberg wanted the opportunity to play, and he wasn't getting that in Edmonton. So December, they sent him down to the minor leagues, and he absolutely ripped it up down there. And now he stepped into the NHL lineup and looked really, really good doing so. So he's really turned a corner here in his development as a prospect for this Oilers team.
With the so one thing that it seemed like the Panthers did really thoughtfully, even as McDavid, I think maybe had more, like McDavid with Bouchard and company on the ice, had more territorial control than I might have expected head to head against Barkov. One thing that the Panthers really seemed to try and do was counterattack at the end of his long shifts. Any adjustment you think the Oilers need to make coming from how the Panthers were able to hold Edmonton off the board, or is it as simple as lift the puck?
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there. You know, the Oilers' defense really struggled early on this season in allowing rush chances against. That was a big point of concern. That really was one of the reasons that led to Jay Woodcroft and Dave Manson's dismissal in November. Now, the Oilers cleaned that area up a lot, but we've seen it throughout the playoffs that it's kind of reared its ugly head again. And, you know, game one was the perfect example of that. I think for the forwards, there needs to be a stronger commitment in getting back and getting deep in the Oilers' own zone when the Panthers are counterattacking. You know, you take a look again at both of those goals against. Connor McDavid got too deep in on the forecheck, and then nobody else was able to get back in time to help pick up Verhaeghe. Second goal, same sort of a thing where, you know, the Oilers got a little bit too deep and got out of position, and the back-checking forwards weren't quite there in time when they needed to be. So, you know, two mistakes like that in the Stanley Cup Finals, and they both end up in the back of their net. I think it's pretty minor adjustments that the Oilers need to make because, you know, if you listen to the team speak in the last couple of days, and even after game one, there was a lot of positivity, and that was something that was kind of really interesting to see from the Oilers. Not that I was expecting them to be, you know, down and out and frustrated and disappointed and angry, but, you know, you've even got a guy like Stuart Skinner who was kind of half cracking jokes in the locker room, you know, with members of the media after the game. So this is a team that's got a very, very strong mindset that truly believes that they are in the right place to be able to compete well against this Panthers team. And I think they also proved that with their play on Monday night. So, you know, there's definitely some areas to clean up in their game, but I do think they're feeling pretty good about where they are as a whole right now.
So I have a theory, because I obviously covered the second round very closely and was wildly impressed by Knobloch's ability to adjust. And yet, one of the adjustments it feels like he always has to make every series is that he has to go away from the Cody Ceci Darnell Nurse pair after reuniting them. Is this Knobloch operating a psyop on us where he's like, oh man, I'll start with this, and then when it doesn't work predictably, I'll get credit for fixing it. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, you might be onto something there. I'll be honest, I was scratching my head when they went back to Nurse and Ceci in the first game against Florida here. You know, you take a look at their play at 5-on-5 in these playoffs, not just this year, but last year as well. Their on-ice goal share at 5-on-5 is absolutely abysmal. I mean, in these playoffs alone, they've been outscored 12-4. Darnell Nurse, you know, everybody's obviously making the he's going for the green jacket jokes and all that kind of stuff. But the thing with his Nurse-CC pairing for me is that I feel that Darnell Nurse, when he's with Cody Ceci, feels like he needs to do too much to cover up for some of the things that Cody Ceci can't do well. You know, you look at Ceci as a defenseman. Yeah, he's generally solid in his own zone, but he really struggles with, you know, moving the puck up the ice and getting out of dangerous situations. So to me, it almost seems like Darnell Nurse thinks that he has to kind of go above and beyond what he's really supposed to be doing. And then he himself is getting caught out of position all the time. You take a look at those couple games he played with Brett Kulak as his partner against Dallas there, and Nurse had three of maybe the best playoff games that I've ever seen from him. He was in position all the time. He was playing calm. He was playing collected. And I think for me, that's the biggest reason why they need to go away from Nurse Ceci, is simply to just let Darnell Nurse be able to play his game without having to do too much on the ice.
Speaking of kind of predictable adjustments for the Oilers, right? I know, I'm sure you have just you're just exhausted about the debate of how much and how often and whether they should play together. Of course, Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, they did get a ton of time together, you know, despite not officially starting the game together in game one. Has Knobloch kind of found like the sweet spot for that, where it's not necessarily option number one, but you still see such a steady diet of it pretty much every game, every series for the Oilers?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you take a look at the percentages of how often they played together over the last 3 years, and it's around 32% at 5-on-5. In the regular season this year, under Knobloch, they dropped it down a couple of percent points, down to about 29%, you know, give or take. But I think the situations in which they're using these guys and going back to them is a lot different. You know, very rarely are we seeing seeing Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl and Zach Hyman on a line to start a game, right? During the game, what we're seeing is after a penalty kill, for example, when the opposing team has, you know, their top units out there, they're loading up McDavid, Draisaitl, and Hyman, trying to take advantage of, you know, a third line or a fourth line that comes out there. So we've seen multiple times this team and these three guys be able to generate offense in those situations. And I think, you know, it's you think of it as like the break glass in case of emergency option with putting these three guys together. And, you know, you got to imagine as a head coach, it's kind of hard to not do that.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at how incredible all three of these guys are. And I think even when you look at any of the coaches who have rotated through Edmonton over the last number of years, a big point of contention and a big issue has those coaches just been going to these three guys on the regular. And I think, you know, Knobloch's ability to kind of get away from that a little bit has really been a key to the Oilers' success.
Just before we let you go, Zach, I wanted to ask about Evander Kane as well. Plays just over 15 minutes in game one. No shots, no shot attempts in those minutes. And, you know, I know he's dealing with an injury, right? He's obviously not at 100%. I also understand why the Oilers might want to keep him in, given the physicality and the ability to agitate from some players on the Florida Panthers side. But are the Oilers reaching a bit of a breaking point here with Evander Kane, where if the effectiveness does not increase as soon as tonight, they might have to consider another option for him?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was some chatter from the morning skates this morning that, you know, he might have been drawing out of the lineup tonight. You know, he said that he's going to be in the lineup, but I think we're going to kind of have to wait and see until, you know, the pregame skate to really understand what's going on here. You know, Evander Kane came out shockingly saying that he had been dealing with a sports hernia ahead of the playoffs, and I think it caught a lot of people off guard because this isn't a time of year where you're hearing players talk publicly about their injuries that they're dealing with. And, you know, you could say, some may say that it's a bit of an excuse of him trying to get ahead of the fact that maybe he's not going to be at his best. And, you know, I thought he's had moments in the playoffs where he's been effective, but at the end of the day, you know, in the last 8 games, Evander Kane has 1 assist and that's it. So his productivity is evidently dropping. You know, he laid the hit on Alex Petrovic late in the first period against Dallas in game 6, and he barely played the rest of that game there. So whether it's the sports hernia that's still bothering him or whether, you know, something else has come up for him in terms of an injury, I do think that the Oilers are kind of reaching a point where they have to make a tough decision here, and potentially that's having Evander Kane out of the lineup. So the nice thing for this Oilers team is they've got a wealth of depth. We've seen them rotating guys through the bottom 6, Derek Ryan, Sam Carrick, Warren Fogle, Ryan McLeod, et cetera, and everybody has come in and played really well for this team in the playoffs. So, you know, even if Evander Kane did slide out of the lineup, somebody would be able to come in and fill the kind of role that he's been playing here.
Zach, really appreciate the time. Enjoy game 2 of the final tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
That is Zach Lang from Oilers Nation, covering the Edmonton Oilers, who, of course, will look to tie the Stanley Cup Final up at 1 game apiece tonight in Florida. You can hear that game here on Sportsnet 650. All right, it is Canucks talk on Sportsnet 650, and one bit of Canucks news, a relatively minor bit of Canucks news that we haven't touched on yet, Drancer. Of course, with the coaching shuffle of last week, Yogi Slavkovsky promoted to assistant coach. That opened up a spot for a skills coach for the Canucks, and they have filled that position. Patrick Alvin today announcing that the Canucks have hired a former Canuck for 4 games, Jason Krog, as a skills and skating coach who will be working with both Vancouver and Abbotsford. And, you know, Jason Krog, if listeners aren't familiar, undrafted, he's from BC, from Fernie, BC, went to the University of New Hampshire, played NCAA hockey, won the Hobie Baker Award in his final season with 85 points in 41 games, and kind of one of those classic 90s, undersized, lifted at 5'10", but probably not that big, but exceptionally skilled NCAA players, makes the NHL as an undrafted player, plays just over 200 games, but is also a phenomenally productive AHL player in his career, right? You know, 112-point season in the AHL, Calder Cup champion, all of those things. So a really interesting hockey career for Jason Krog. Now he's the skills coach, and I know also that he has been, you know, informally running some of those summer skates that the Canucks do before they, you know, actually report for training camp. So some familiarity with him in the organization and the players as well.
Manitoba Moose legend,
mm-hmm.
Jason Krog. I mean, he was immense in the American League throughout his career, honestly.
His numbers in the AHL are ridiculous. Are, like, absolutely incredible.
1.12 points per game.
Yeah.
Absurd, absurd stuff. Well, and, you know, honestly, even his American League, or even his NHL numbers, like, obviously nothing to write home about, but 24 points most nights he's playing, like, 6 minutes, you know, just, like, give us a game. This is the classic, like, I swear if Jason Krog was coming up now, was a 19-year-old kid now, 5'10", buck 90, maybe would have a shot. Maybe in a different league, a more scoring-based league. After the fixed percentages era, maybe he'd be able to carve out a role. I'm just glad to see them replace what Yogi Shevkovsky had on his plate prior to accepting the assistant coach's job. I think asking him to continue to focus on skills, and I'm sure he'll collaborate closely with Krog, but I think asking him to retain that portfolio while adjusting in a major way to having an assistant coach's job being on the bench, something he's just never done at the pro level, I think that's big and important. And obviously Krog's, you know, been around. He's played a lot of NHL games. He's familiar with a lot of Canucks players and has run some captain skates over the years. So, interesting player during his time, an interesting choice to fill Yogi's departed role or vacated role as a result of him moving up the chain.
Yeah, and I also noted just after the announcement was made and doing just a little bit of research, Patrick Johnston wrote an article, I think back in 2022, reporting on Krog running some of those informal summer skates, and also noted the longstanding relationship between Jason Krog and Canucks assistant general manager Ryan Johnson, who actually crossed over briefly as players with the Canucks but have known each other long before that. So lots of connections between Krog and the Canucks organization, that built-in familiarity, and he joins the staff as the new skills and skating coach. And again, he'll be working with both Vancouver and Abbotsford. So that's the latest on the Canucks coaching staff hires. 650-650 in the Dunbar Lumber text line. Cole in Ontario says, can someone give some kind of update on Zadorov? And I can't personally, but I can relay what Rick Dhaliwal had to say on Donnie and Dolly earlier today, Cole, which was basically not much. Still quiet on Zadorov. No talks, no offers. That matches what we heard a little bit, at least, last week. Of course, there were some conflicting reports on Zadorov and Lindholm and where they stood in contract negotiations. But the theme continues to be, for the Vancouver Canucks, outside of Tyler Myers, who Rick Dhaliwal reported they're still talking to, right? Obviously, deal's not done, but all indications point there's a lot of reason for optimism that they're going to be able to get something out, get something figured out with Tyler Myers. Beyond that, I don't know that we've heard, things are moving in one a positive direction on any other free agent, right? Even including Philip Roenick as an RFA there, right? Like, it's been quiet on Joshua, quiet on Zadorov, quiet on Lindholm, although now we're hearing from Elliot Friedman that it's, you know, looking like he's going to depart. Ian Cole going to free agency. Casey DeSmith going to free agency. Haven't heard anything on Teddy Bluger. And I'm not saying any of this as an insult to the Canucks, right? Or a criticism of the Canucks. It could absolutely be the case that none of these guys are going to be available at numbers that make sense for the Canucks. I just think it's striking that outside of Tyler Myers, really, it's been pretty consistent, not much happening with any of the other free agents.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure a lot is happening in terms of conversations and discussions, if not formal offers. And, you know, there's 3 weeks. The Canucks still have plenty of time to keep whoever they're willing to, you know, bend to keep, right? But they haven't done so yet, and that's kind of how these work, right? There's a lot of players eyeing really big paydays on July 1. You know, if you're Dakota Joshua, right? And here's the other thing. Like, if you're Dakota Joshua, as just to pick one example, his career earnings, his estimated career earnings per cap friendly, $1.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know that he would love to stay in Vancouver, right? But when you're 27 and you've spent a decade chasing your professional hockey career and this opportunity is in front of you, like, you can want to stay as much as you want. You can want to cut your current team a break even. But that break has to be at a certain point.
Yep.
Because this is vital, like, for his family, for, like, generations of Joshuas. This matters a lot. And this is what you're navigating. Like, we talked about this a few weeks ago. It, because of the team's success and how little of their upside was locked up with term, right? Until July 1, this team's success and the role all of these individual players played on it works for them. July 2nd, July 3rd, that's when Vancouver's team success becomes an edge for Canucks management in filling out the gaps. And, I think this is one we're just going to have to watch it play out. All of these are going to be hard. The Canucks are going to have to bend to get any of them done. When they bend, we'll know. But I wouldn't expect huge updates until that happens, because all of these players have just a whole whack of leverage, and the Canucks have to be so, so careful with how they navigate it all.
And on Joshua in particular, another note to pass along from Elliot Friedman, I believe it was on 32 Thoughts, not the Merrick Show. I think it was on the latest edition of 32 Thoughts, referencing that, you know, depth forwards who can play a heavy game and move up and down your lineup are going to be very, very in demand, which they're in demand every summer, but he's saying even beyond normally are.
Jamie, that's the scoop of the year.
No. But he's
big
saying even beyond,
forward
even beyond
demand.
That, and specifically says Dakota Joshua is the poster boy this year for that type of player, right? So he's saying beyond just the, you know, perennially in demand player is going to be in demand. He's saying at the head of that class this year is Dakota Joshua, right? Which gives you some insight into, like, yeah, the market is going to be very, very robust. He's number one kind of on the list of a player type that teams are always, always eager to go sign on July 1st.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hearing of, like, three different Eastern Conference teams that are gung-ho. I mean, no shocker, right? Good hands and tight, penalty mm-hmm. killing, hits, defense teammates, can skate. I mean, what more do you want from X depth forward, right? There's a lot of guys you can spend $3 million on who aren't giving you, you know, half as many, like, unique traits as what Joshua will bring to the table. Hard to do, right? Zadorov, by the way, is kind of the same.
Yep.
Right? Like, there's a lot of defensemen available. There's a lot of big defensemen available. There's a lot of big, reliable defensemen available. Do they also wear the heck out of a turtleneck and stomp people over, like, absolutely steamroll any defender with their head down and then say something funny about it? Like, are they a literal Arnold Schwarzenegger character on the ice or not? Because, you know, that's something a lot of teams will be willing to pay a premium for. And, you know, God bless them. They're right to.
All right, we will take a break on that note. Jonathan Wall joining us, of course, former member of the Canucks front office. Always a pleasure to chat with Jay Wall, and lots to get into with him today. So we'll wrap up the show chatting with Jay Wall next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. This hour brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. And as mentioned, we're now very pleased to be joined once again on the show. Former Canucks front office member, he is Jonathan Wall. Jonathan, thank you as always for doing this. It's been a while since we chatted. How are you?
My pleasure, guys. Always great to be on with you. I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day here in the Okanagan and happy to be on.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you. There's just a lot of salary cap and salary cap adjacent stuff happening. There's the news that the Penticton Young Stars schedule was announced, so we can chat about that as well. But just in general, so what's your kind of big picture takeaway for the salary cap going up in the NHL by a significant amount, all the way to $88 million for next year? You know, the biggest rise we've seen in quite some time. What do you think that's going to mean for the sport, for how teams operate, for the free agent market this summer?
I think it's going to help all the teams. I think just having a little bit more breathing room is going to be a benefit. I think the owners are going to push their GMs to spend the money and to do it quickly. So I don't know how much room is going to be left of that increase as we work our way through the summer, but I think it just gives flexibility. And I think as an increase that's coming sort of for the first time in a while, I do wonder if teams may try to manage it a little more carefully than they have, understanding the value of cap space now and trying to keep some available as they move through the season.
For teams, though, as you talked about, you know, that idea of discipline, and I'm sure there will be a lot of teams trying to exercise that discipline, but, you know, for a team like the Canucks specifically, who the salary cap has gone up, they also have significant cap space on top of that. How hard is it as an organization to stay disciplined when you do all of a sudden have a lot of additional flexibility, have a lot of additional cap dollars to spend?
It is hard. I mean, you get into these situations where you identify players, you put a lot of work into identifying players, recruiting players, trying to get players to sign with you, and you go down that road. And at some point you sort of get, I don't want to say you get caught up in it, but you sort of have committed yourself to these players a bit, and the agents know that. And they're shopping on the open market and trying to get the most money they can for their clients. So a lot of times when there is extra money to be spent, it does get spent just because of that.
John, I had a take in our second segment about how one thing I was suggesting a team like the Canucks, which, you know, might need an additional top player, right? Not just to fill out the roster, but to add like a difference maker, might want to consider is saving some cap space for the season. Because if a top player ever comes available, it's usually like a trade request, a sudden spate of scratches, some kind of falling out with their organization. Like, it's often one of those situations where you need flexibility to react to it, or having flexibility to react to it puts you in the driver's seat. What are some of the advantages of approaching it that way? What are some of the risks?
Well, I think absolutely the advantages are that as the season goes on, the cap space increases. You're using less of a percentage of the total cap space when you acquire a player in season. So it does give you some flexibility to acquire a better player. The challenge is, you know, you've got a lot of pressure trying to get out of the gate, you know, strong. I think I thought this in my time with the Canucks, and I've seen it with some other sports. I think coming out of a season like the Canucks had, I do think there's some pressure internally to give the players a bit of a boost. You know, they played a hard playoff series. They probably felt they were, you know, pretty close to a team that's now in the finals. You know, I think coming out of the summer, those players want to see that the organization has sort of stepped up and given them a bit of a boost. You know, I remember in the 2010 offseason, you know, signing Manny and Dan Hamm, who's, you know, our team was, and Raffy, you know, our team was really, you know, excited to get that season underway because they kind of got that boost from a team that, you know, had fallen short a couple years before.
And other cap adjacent news, we saw the Washington Capitals reportedly acquire Cap Friendly, and of course the people who are using that site or maintaining that site, a huge loss for the hockey community. What do you think there's a meaningful competitive advantage that the Capitals will net taking that site offline, depriving rival NHL teams of that resource?
I think there are other sites that have stepped up and are providing, you know, comparable information. I think that's a challenge. I know, you know, in my time with the Canucks, we did look at acquiring different either scouting information or other information. At some point, if the information is available elsewhere, you sort of don't get, you know, that big of an advantage because people can still find it elsewhere. Obviously, though, you know, the Capitals felt that this was a move, and either it was hiring personnel and, you know, making, you know, just making it exclusive to them. I do think, you know, Cap Friendly, you know, has done a great job since it started. I remember working with Dom, you know, when it started, we would talk to each other and just kind of bounce stuff off each other. He would, you know, he'd have questions about different things, and their knowledge and their expertise is just tremendous. So, you know, I think it is going to help the Caps in some ways, but I think there are going to be other sites that step up and try to, you know, fill that void a little bit.
And, you know, it's cap friendly. And of course, before that, Cap Geek, and now it'll be Puckpedia, like invaluable, just essential resource for certainly us doing our job. But I know for fans, like the salary cap is so important. And just even if you're not, if you don't care about the nitty gritty of the salary cap, right? Like to see a list of free agents who are coming up this summer, all of those things, right? So valuable for fans. But for teams, I mean, do you have a sense of how much teams around the league would rely on resources like this that are, you know, public facing, but obviously the Capitals see a lot of value, they're buying it. How much do teams use and value a resource like Cap Friendly?
I think they use it a lot. I think they value it a lot. I think it provides a really good sort of close enough guide to what's going on around the league. You know, it's not something that I would have, you know, staked my career on making a trade that their numbers were 100% accurate. They were generally pretty close though.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of a quick snapshot, if you're in a rush, like a lot of times it would be a really good resource. And it's part of a package that as we were, you know, heading towards free agency, the draft, you know, we would use our proprietary cap software or cap information, working with the NHL, and then create sort of bigger documents that we would use for those events. So it would be part of a bigger package where we would want to know teams' cap space, their draft pick, their draft pick inventory, injuries, how many players they needed to fill their roster, all those things. So in terms of a quick snapshot, it's definitely a hugely valuable tool.
Do you think it would serve the NHL? And I know Gary Bettman has kind of poo-pooed this idea in the past, and maybe there's complications with, you know, the confidentiality of salary information, things like that. But would it serve the NHL to host, run some sort of public database along these lines, right? Because there is so much tremendous interest, and it is so vital for fans and for media to be able to cover and follow the sport these days.
I mean, it's a hard one. I think, you know, the NHL ultimately works on behalf of its member teams. And I think, you know, ultimately, I don't know if the member teams would want the NHL using its resources to put it public. They may. But, you know, over time, the amount of knowledge of fans and the interest in all this stuff. And I mean, a good example is the fact that, you know, you guys are still having me on, you know, years after I left the organization, because people do, you know, are really interested in the cap and sort of this behind the scenes running of teams.
J-Wall, when these resources have shut down, because obviously Cap Geek is the one we remember when Matthew West passed, tragically. There was also General Fanager, which then replaced it, and then Tom was hired by the Vegas Golden Knights. And so this is sort of like, this was, Cap Friendly was 3.0 and almost got to a point, did get to a point, that I wouldn't have even believed, where it was a more powerful tool than Cap Geek even was in its heyday. You know, the feature that I'm going to miss the most is all the confirmed data, like things like when a guy hits group six, you know, like I have my own spreadsheets to track it, but I sometimes, you know, slack on them and then go back to Cap Friendly and repeat my data. When you think about what it takes to run these sites, I mean, is the toolkit developed by, whether it's Dom, whether it's Tom, sort of building and then managing these sites, do you think it's a good preparation actually for actually being a bookkeeper the way you were for so many years?
Well, I mean, one of the first things when Lawrence Gilman came on to the Canucks organization, him and I sat down and he really walked me through a lot of the cap tracking and managing, you know, that he was comfortable with. And I started sort of changing how I did a lot of that stuff. And Thomas, like, you know, if you to say that you kept your own spreadsheets, you know, we did the same and we managed it and verified it and everything. But, you know, that sort of daily, you know, management of it really gives you a good sense of what's going on in the market. And it really forces you to, again, stay on top of things, and you're seeing signings and, you know, what players are becoming free and what's happening to them. So it really, you know, it does put you in a position that you are knowing what's going on. I think with Dom too, the other advantage he had is he was sort of, you know, in some ways a bit of a safe space that organizations could reach out to him and pick his brain and vice versa. So he probably, you know, was getting information or dialogue with, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 you know, capologists or, you know, assistant GMs or whatever you want to talk about or whatever you want to call them. So I think, you know, someone in those roles, I think, does get a lot of information. No different from, you know, the group at Staffleets or one of the data tracking providers where they're working with multiple teams and they have a really good sense what teams are looking for and how they do their business.
And with all of this cap growth hitting the system, I mean, the cap's going to go up more this summer than it has in the last 5 years combined. I mean, what do you remember about times of aggressive cap growth? And what are some things to look for or like gut check on for our listeners, just in terms of how to prepare for some of the slanted numbers that we could be seeing, some of the numbers that are almost untethered to what's come before, especially over the last 5 years?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think when you see growth, the top teams, you know, manage their cap and they have their setup and, you know, they sort of fill their needs as they go. I think where we saw the biggest sort of influence was maybe on the floor teams. And I remember a story of a player, you know, who was offered a contract by a floor team. And I want to say it was, they thought they were getting $4 million over 2 years. But I think in reality, it was $4 million a year for 2 years. It just, you know, the spending at the bottom, just it became almost funny money. Like, we have to spend it, so let's just spend it. And that's where it drives sort of inflation up through the market.
And, so the cap is going to take this big jump going into this summer. And we were having the conversation earlier in the show, right? There's reason to believe it could continue to take a couple more big jumps after that. You do want to be cautious with that. What's that kind of long-term cap planning process like within a team, right? Because you don't want to be overly cautious, right, and be scared of committing money down the road if the cap does go up, but you also have to be careful you're not just assuming like, oh, hey, you know, the cap's going to keep going up, so everything will be fine. How do you kind of try to make the best projections to arm yourself going forward?
I mean, it's really hard. You've got so many stakeholders involved in your, you know, in your spending, and not that they all have the same voice or the same say, but you've got obviously your owners who have expectations. You've got a head coach who may be on a shorter term contract or is looking, you know, to put the best team on the ice as possible. You've got, you know, players that are potentially going to have to re-sign that need to see, growth of the team and need to see an investment in the team. You've got free agents you're trying to recruit that, you know, you sort of know you need and you sort of get caught up in spending on them. So it is really hard to just say, okay, we're going to save this money. Because if you don't spend it and you end up losing, then you've sort of squandered an advantage that you could have. So it is really hard to sort of to put your foot in the ground or, you know, draw a line in the sand and say, we're not going to spend that money, because you're looking around at what other teams are doing and you want to compete and you want to win. And, you know, you just don't know when, you know, you're going to have that season where you just kind of put everything together and wish you had spent that money a little more aggressively for that one player you need, or, you know, that extra depth piece that could help you down the road.
And before we let you go, Jonathan, as I mentioned, you know, the Canucks confirmed that the Penticton Young Stars tournament on again for September. They announced the schedule. The Western Canadian teams will be participating. And just, you know, I know you're still involved with the tournament. How excited are you? How big a deal is it for the teams involved and for Penticton as well?
Well, yeah, thanks for asking. I mean, it's a great thing. I mean, my involvement over years has actually kind of gone down a bit because really the venue we have here in Penticton and the staff at the venue is world-class. I mean, there's very few venues that can host an event like this. And, you know, the city of Penticton is a huge supporter. You know, new hotels are being built. So, you know, we're super excited. You know, you look at the Stanley Cup final, I just quickly before I came on air, I think I counted 16 players in the final that played in Penticton at the Young Stars. So it's a great spot for the players on those teams to get great exposure, great experience in front of a live game atmosphere with big crowds, with game presentation. And obviously you've got, you know, the Okanagan is kind of split between the four teams anyway. So, you know, when you've got Edmonton or Calgary, Vancouver, Winnipeg playing, you've got a lot of their home fans in the building, which makes for a really fun atmosphere. And we've also built up the event with a lot of ancillary events as well to really make it a celebration of hockey in Penticton for that weekend. So we're super excited to keep it going and just build on the success we've had before.
Jonathan, really appreciate the time. And yeah, I know all our listeners and Canucks fans are excited for the tournament as well. That's September 13th to 16th in Penticton this year. We look forward to it. And thank you as always for chatting with us.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure. We'll talk.
Absolutely. That is Jonathan Wall, former member of the Canucks front office and running the salary cap for them for a long time. And as I said, just a lot of salary cap news, including, I don't want to say the demise because they're being bought, but the end of cap friendly as a public utility. And it really is hard. Like it would be hard to overstate how important cap friendly is to, you know, fans following the team. But like, I just think about doing my job. I've been trying to transition to Puckpedia today just to like ease into it, get used to it. But I have like multiple cap friendly tabs open at all times during the course of our show. Right. And I get it, like, oh, we're like the salary cap nerd show or whatever. But even if you're not into the nitty gritty of the salary cap and like group six free agents, there's just so much information available on cap friendly in an easy to digest package that makes doing the job so much easier.
So I was in the pool when I found out. And I got out and I went to my computer and I did my protocol. I've been around long enough now that this has happened to me three times and I've got a protocol for how I handle it. I know exactly what information I need to preserve so that I can effectively mimic what I was getting from the site while waiting for, you know, and Puckpedia, like Hart, who manages Puckpedia, does a great job, super knowledgeable, super sharp. Mm-hmm. But the tools on Cap Friendly,
yep,
the positional tracking, the group six free agents, the waiver exemption calculator, like there's some real robust tools there that I use daily just to like quickly check things. So I'm going to need to be able to manage my own resource until someone comes up with something comparable. And by the way, they always do, but there is usually a lag. So I have an actual protocol in place. I know exactly what to save. And I go about doing it. There's Word documents involved. There's spreadsheet building involved. And I spent an hour just making sure that I was going to be okay. Like it's like a emergency protocol that I enact when I lose my favorite resources. And man, have I lost some of my favorite resources over the years. You know, multiple times to the Caps now, given that Tim Barnes is there and that took time on ice from me. So this is the job. It gets harder every year in some ways, right? Like you have these world-class tools and resources and then they go away and then they get replaced by new world-class resources, some of which actually end up outpacing the originals.
Mm-hmm.
Some of which the originals will always be the best, right? Like love Natural Stat Trick. It's a phenomenal site. You know, it's certainly a good replacement for Warren Ice, but like Extra Skater, which is now in-house proprietary Leaf stuff. Like that's all time. That's the best all time. So sometimes it gets replaced in full. Sometimes it gets replaced in part and the wider hockey community does its best. Certainly the league should have a resource for some stuff like this though. I see no reason to believe that a time sync site like that with people interacting with players and teams and building their own armchair GM stuff,
yes,
and figuring out trade compliance and being smarter in how they talk about the game. Like I see no way that doesn't benefit everybody involved in the sport.
Yeah. Somebody texted in right off the top of the show. Yesterday was a sad, sad day for armchair GMs, RIP cap friendly. Right. And as you said, like the amount of activity from fans that happens on that site, building out, okay, here's what I think the roster should look like. And it's shared on Twitter and people can debate it. Like that's exactly what the NHL should be trying to capture. And I find it bizarre, the idea that like, no, people don't really care about the salary cap information. And I get that maybe is just like a spin from Gary Bettman, but it's just so,
yeah, it's convenience.
So flagrantly untrue. Like even for spin, it's so thin and so just like absolutely not the case. I always find it a little bizarre when I hear that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's probably more for the people who are already going to spend their disposable income on the NHL product. So the league has to be more concerned with like new revenue growth. It's like, if you're on cap friendly doing armchair GM.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you're hooked. You're already hooked. The fans I'm interested in don't care about that. I'm interested in the new fans. Okay. Whatever. Anyway, I still think it helps the league.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. And
Yeah.
The thing is, those fans that are already hooked are helping to drive the conversation, right? Like that's by giving your most hardcore fans an outlet to learn more and follow it more closely, they are creating hype for you, right? They can help create interest in the product for people who aren't already super attached to it, right? So I get that. Hey, we've already got these people, we don't need to worry about them, but I don't know. I think that's a very short-sighted view of it. Ultimately, I also say there's something like, I feel like hockey, these tools and websites that crop up in hockey are like uniquely prone to being bought out and going dark compared to resources across other sports. Like I think about like FanGraphs in baseball. Like the information available at FanGraphs is like off the charts. Would blow anything we have in hockey out of the water. It's never been bought. I don't know. I don't have a larger point to make this. It just seems like every time there's this incredible resource in the NHL world, in the hockey world, it inevitably gets bought and ends up going dark. And I don't quite understand why that is.
Well, a lot of it's, I think it's because the resources are tough. I think it's the resources are also significantly outpaced what the league itself offers.
Mm.
And then the last part of this is, even though FanGraphs itself hasn't gone offline at any point, like many of its writers,
sure,
many of the people
do.
Working there have. Yeah. So, but yeah, no, it's interesting and a reminder too. Like there's ways into this business. There's ways into the industry. If you're smart, if you're creative, especially if you can code and do a little bit of website design, like if you can build a tool and cater to what hockey fans and hockey people want to see, you know, I hope there's some people who find some inspiration too. The rewards are actually significant, right? Like there are opportunities, life opportunities, experience that can originate if you do work well. And if you have, you know, the knowledge base and the technical skills to back it up the way Dom certainly does. A great guy, and I'm happy for him, even as I'm sad for us.
We will end it on that note. Remember, game 2 of the Stanley Cup Final, you can hear here on the station tonight. And we will be back tomorrow for another edition of Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.